the invitation. It's very nice to be here. I want to talk about, so it's actually two different works with these people, Matthias Christland, Aram Harrow, Michal Horodesk, and John Yard. And the common theme of both of this work is they tells us something about what we call quantum data hygiene. So what I want to do is I just want to first tell you what data hygiene is in quantum states. And I want to give you an example where we can hide data from kind of observables that we can implement locally with classical communication. Then I want to give some, just mention some other examples of where data hygiene appears. Then I want to show how this, you know, this idea of data hygiene appears in the problem of trying to decide if a state is entangled or not. So trying to find a good procedure to decide if a quantum state is entangled or not. And we'll see that in a sense, these data hygiene states, they are the hardest case. So they are the quantum states which are the most difficult to determine if they are entangled or not computationally. Then I want to change topic a little bit and talk about a different type of data hygiene, which is the case where we want to hide data from like adversary, which has restrictions on the computation power. So it can only implement measurements, which can be implemented by polynomial size circuits, for example, or something equivalent. And then we'll see that to understand this problem, it will be convenient to understand something about structure of random quantum circuits, and in particular, understand how they mimic properties from the Haar measure. And we'll get to that. Then finally, I just want to mention another problem where this concept of data hygiene seems to be very important, which is in trying to prove area loss for gap models in 2D, 1D, 2D, etc. Then I don't have much to say, but first I want to point out this connection with data hygiene. Then I want to show something that I have been thinking about, which is trying to see if a better understanding of data hygiene might be useful to solve this problem. Although I only have some preliminary results. Okay, so let's see what this data hygiene is about. There is a example which is very famous in quantum information theory and is very simple too. And let me first present it to you. So the idea here is the following. Suppose we have a finite dimensional Hilbert space. So we have Alice and Bob space. Alice space is d-dimensional, and so is Bob's. And now suppose, let's define P symmetric and P antisymmetric as the projectors onto the symmetric and the antisymmetric subspaces of this space. And then we can define states associated to these projectors, which are just the normalized projectors. So this we call W minus, which is just a normalized symmetric projector, and W plus is the antisymmetric. And then these two projects, they are orthogonal one to another, and therefore these two states, they are orthogonal one to another. So it means that if we make just a quantum measurement, which tells in which subspace we are able to distinguish these two states perfectly with no error at all. Now suppose that we cannot, these are bipartite states. They act on this bipartite Hilbert space. So suppose that they are shared by two parties, for example, Alice and Bob, and they are separated in space. So they can only apply local quantum operations to their system, and they can communicate to each other, but only classically. They have like a telephone line. Then they cannot implement any measurements that quantum mechanics would allow. They can only implement what we call this local operations and classical communication measurements. So anything that they can do by Alice performing a local operation and then communicates to Bob, Bob performs some other measurement, communicates to Alice, and so on. And then we can try to see how they can distinguish these two states now by this restricted class of measurements, this LOCC measurements. And then there is this result from 2002, which tells that in the case of LOCC measurements, they cannot distinguish them at all. So they can distinguish them only if probability bigger than half plus 1 over g. So if they just guess which state they have, they would distinguish probability half. It says that they can only do better than just guessing by a factor of 1 over d, which, you know, when d is very large, is goes to zero. So it means that there is a big gap between what they can do by global measurements and what they can do by LOCC measurements. And yes?
You're saying they have one or two states?
Yeah. So they are given either W minus or W plus, and they don't know which one they have.
But there's also a theorem that if you have one or two states, you can distinguish which one is one or two of those states.
By LCC, if they're pure.
If they are, these are mixed.
These are mixed, right? Yes, they are normalized, yeah. It's a good point. So if the two states are pure, you can always do as well by LCC as global measurements. If they are mixed, it can change a lot. And then you can like hide one bit of information. So suppose you want to commit to zero in a way that if you want to commit to zero, you prepare the state W minus. If you want to commit to one, you prepare the state W plus. Then if you have access to global measurements, you can learn for sure what is the value of the bit. But if you only have access to LCC measurements, you cannot learn with any non-negligible probability. And this is what we call data hiding. So this is one example. So before we get into some other examples, let's just put some notation that we are going to use further in the talk. And let's introduce some norm that we call LCC norm. So first, let's remind what the trace norm is. It's very simple. So we have two quantum states, rho and sigma. We can define this trace norm as some constant 2 times the maximum over all P of M elements. So M is a positive semi-definite operator, all eigenvalues smaller than 1, of trace M rho minus sigma. So it's like the bias of measuring rho. If you measure 2 outcome P of M given by M and identity minus M, trace M rho is the probability that you measure M and in the state rho. And trace M sigma is the probability that you measure M in the state sigma. So this is like the bias. So the trace knob tells about the optimal probability of distinguishing two quantum states. So for example, for W minus and W plus, this is just 2 because of this factor. We can do the same thing. So this is, a general quantum measurement. We can put some extra conditions on this measurement. And to get this LCC norm, we just say, okay, we consider the same thing as the trace norm, but now the P of M and identity minus M must be implemented by LCC. So we have this further constraint there. And then, for example, for these states we considered before, they are perfectly distinguishable. So the trace norm, half of the trace norm is 1. So it means that they are perfectly distinguishable. A way of expressing that they are not distinguished by LCC is saying that half of the LCC norm is very small. It's smaller than 1 over D. So when we talk about data hiding, we can just talk by LCC, we can just talk about the difference of the trace norm distance to the LCC distance. And we are going to do that. So this is one example of data hiding, but you can see many other things in quantum information theory as examples of data hiding as well. So you know, error correcting codes you can see as data hiding against measurements that only act on a local parts of the state. The same thing for topological order. Then using this connection of error correcting codes and data hiding, these proposals for quantum secret sharing schemes have been put forward. And then there is this original paper where they introduced this idea of hiding bits in quantum states from 2001. Then we are going to see maybe later that if you want to create these data hiding states, if you do at random, generically it will be the case. So if you take some random state, mixed state, in general it will be very good data hiding properties. And finally, these ideas of data hiding, it's useful even, it has been used to prove big gaps between how much key you can extract from a quantum state and how much the syllable entanglement you can extract. So these two things, they were believed to be equivalent some time ago. They are not, and data hiding is the way to do it. Yes?
Another thing that might be on that list could be work on fit commitments.
Right.
Is that fair? I mean, which, the way you've described it so far, is pretty much equivalent to data hiding, given technological assumptions of that.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, maybe I should have put it in. Yeah, thanks. Okay, so I'm not going to talk about these applications. I just want to present two new results concerning data hiding. So the first is about trying to decide when a state is entangled or not. So when we have a pure state, suppose we have a bipartite pure state, psi AB, on a d-dimensional versus l-dimensional space, then it's very easy to see if it's entangled or not, right? So if you can write in this product form, then it's entangled, it's separable. If not, it's entangled. For mixed states, the definition is a bit more complicated. So we say it's separable, so it's not entangled, if we can write as a convex combinations with weight pi of product states. And if doesn't exist any decomposition of this form, then we say it's entangled. So it's more difficult. So here it's easy to tell. We can just compute the reduced state on Alice or Bob. If it's mixed, then it's entangled. If it's not, it's separable. Here is much harder. So the problem I want to analyze, one way to motivate it is by what people doing some experiments. So what they like to do is to try to prepare a quantum system there, and a way to say that it's quantum is to argue that there is entanglement there. So they have a source, they prepare many copies of the same state, do some measurements, have the measurement results, then they do some statistical analysis, get some plots like this, which should be close to the true state being prepared. And then they would like to satisfy if it's entangled or not. So given the density matrix describing this bipartite state between A and B, they want to find out if it's entangled or not. So this for experimentalists, the way we see the problem is like that. Suppose we have this mixed state on a bipartite Hilbert space. We don't know if it's entangled. And to formalize it, it's convenient to use this idea of weak membership problem. So the problem is the following. Given rho AB, we want to determine either if it's separable, so this is the set of separable states, this convex set, or if it's epsilon away from any separable state. So we have a promise. Either the state is here in separable, or it's here in this outside of this epsilon neighborhood of separable. And given that we have this promise, we want to decide which is the case. And we want to count resources. So we want to see what's the most efficient way of doing this. So the relevance of this problem. As I said, so if you're interested in quantum cryptography, then you can only have security if the state is entangled. So this is the first test you want to do to see if you have entanglement there. Quantum communication, the same thing. So we have this advantage of a classical in teleportation of dense coding, only if the state is entangled. So it's also first test you want to do there. And even there is some more technical application that if you have a good handle on this weak membership problem, this gives you a better way of estimate the ground state energy of mean field models, at least when the dimension of the local spins increases. So this is like in computational physics, this problem is also interesting. Okay, so this has been studied for a while now, this problem. And we know we have many nice things developed with the aim of analyzing it. We have this PPTC test, this entanglement witnesses, symmetric extensions, etc. But unfortunately, when we look at algorithms and really to try to rigorously analyze how well we can solve this problem, it's really bad, the time scaling. So it's like exponential. This is the local is the dimension of the A system. So it's exponential in the local dimension. So if it's a d by d system, it's 2 to the g. And in the arrow, it's a bit better, it's polynomial. So it's really, it's really difficult to solve this problem. This is what we learn. And we also understand why it should be difficult. We have some computational hardness results for this problem. So the problem is we want to know if it's entangled, non-entangled, or epsilon away from any separable state. And first, this problem is NP-hard. So when this epsilon is exponentially small in the dimensions. So this is very small, but in this case, it means that we have no hope of solving this problem efficiently, basically. Then this was improved even when the error, the accuracy is just one of a polynomial in the dimension. So it's still very hard. And the best result in this direction, it says something strong. It says that if we fix two positive numbers, nu and mu, then there is not even an algorithm of this complexity. So, exponential in some constant times log 1 minus nu a, log 1 minus mu b. So even sub-exponential in a and b for constant error. And this when we decide when epsilon is measured in the trace knob. So here we don't have NP hardness for this problem, but we have that if we had this algorithm, it would imply we can solve SAT in sub-exponential time. So it's also unlikely. So it seems that this problem is indeed very hard. So what we got a new algorithm for this problem. So the first thing I want to show you. So with Matthias, Chris, and John Yard, last, yes. Yeah.
The result, it doesn't depend on the accuracy.
Anyway. It's for constant accuracy.
Okay.
They have a universal constant that is very small. I don't even know, it's not explicit.
Okay.
But for this one, they have this. Right, so let me tell you what we got. We could get algorithm of this scale. So in the error is very bad, it's exponential in the error. But in the dimension, it's much better than what we knew before. It's an exponential saving here in log A, log B. Instead of A, we have log A, log B now. But the thing is that we can solve this problem using this LOCC norm to quantify the error. So the error is quantifying the LOCC norm. So if you compare with this Heron-Montanari result, it looks very nice because this time scaling is exactly the minimum time scales that they don't rule out. So anything faster than this, it will be ruled out by their result. Unfortunately, the norms are different. So we can prove for LOCC norm, they can only prove for trace norm. So if we had the same algorithm working for trace norm, we would have the optimal algorithm for deciding attainment, right? Because anything better would lead to a sub-exponential algorithm for SATs, which we don't believe. So I think that we are close to getting the right order of this problem. Yes?
Sorry, what's the meaning of the result? So this algorithm that you have tells you that, what's the meaning of measuring things with this norm?
It tells us, so suppose you have a state, and then you want to know either it's separable or it's epsilon away from separable.
Yes.
But when you measure this distance to separable in the LOCC norm.
Yeah, but what does it mean to measure in this norm?
It means that if you find out that your state is epsilon close to separable, it means that if you do any LOCC protocol to your state, it will behave like a separable state.
Right. So you may find that it's separable, but it's not separable. Is that?
It might be far away from separable, but if it is far away from separable, you'll never be able.
As long as LOCC looks like separable, is that almost separable?
No, as long as you're only going to process your state by LOCC, it will look like separable.
Right.
So then you don't care.
It behaves
like separable with respect to LOCC.
Okay.
Exactly. Yeah. If you are able to do a global measurement, then it might be completely off.
Okay.
So
LOCC norm, when you say it might be completely off, is there some proportionality?
Yes.
Yeah.
So it's the worst that it can be is the dimension, local dimension. So the LOCC norm is always bigger than 1 over local dimension times trace norm. And this can be the case for this Verne states, for example.
So is it correct at some intuitive level to think of this norm of telling you also about how distillable the state is?
Yeah, it's for sure. That
as opposed to telling you how much time we need to create the state, which would be the trace.
Exactly. Yeah, it is. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So it really tells if you have this bipartite states and all you care about is what you can do by LOCC, then really you care about the LOCC norm and not the trace norm. If you care about you do some quantum computation there and then you care about global operations, then you care about trace norm.
Sorry, just to make sure I understood.
Yeah.
That means this is a much easier test?
So, yes, if you use the LOCC norm, it should be easier than using the trace norm.
Maybe greatly easier.
So what we know now is that for trace norm, we cannot do better than this. And for LOCC norm, we for sure can do this. So like they match, but the norms are wrong. So, you know. And then what the problem that we have, like really trying to close this gap, is really this data hiding states, right? Because we can have states where the minimum distance, this is the minimum distance with respect to separable states of row. In one norm, it's much bigger than the LOCC norm. We just saw an example using this this projector onto the antisymmetric state, for example. This state, which is the normalized projector onto the antisymmetric subspace. So really, you know, so this is what I meant when I said that these data hiding states are the hardest, in a sense. Really, if you say your state is not data hiding, in the sense that these two norms are comparable, then we have an algorithm that matches hardness result. But since we have these guys, we don't know. So to give you an idea why this property of being data hiding appears in this problem, let me tell you a bit more about how you get this result. And this result comes from studying a property of a famous property of quantum correlations, which we call monogamy of entanglement. Meaning that, for example, if we have three quantum systems and two of them are maximally entangled, then they cannot be correlated with anything else. So this is some extreme case, and it's useful to argue about quantum cryptography, for example. But we also can quantify the trade-offs here. So suppose this is a mistake, it should be sigma AB, sorry. So suppose we have a state sigma AB which is separable. Then we know we can write in this way, as a convex combination of product states. So one thing that we find from this is that the correlations between A and B, they are shareable. We can share them freely. And what I mean by that is that we can have an extension of the state, where instead of having one B, we have KB systems now, where the correlations between A and each one of the B systems is the same as in the original state, in the sense that if you trace out here all the Bs except one of them, we recover the original state, right? Because we are just tracing out K minus one of these copies of sigma BJ. So it means that classical correlations, we can just share them. There is no monogamy here. A can be entangled with as many Bs as Alice can be entangled with as many, sorry, Alice can be correlated with as many Bobs as she wants with no problem. So let's just introduce a way to talk about these extensions. We say that the state rho AB is K extendable if we can find a bigger state on A, B1 to BK of this form, for example, such that if we trace out all the J's, this from 1 to K. So if we trace out, we fix any J from 1 to K, and we trace out, this means tracing out all the B systems except the BJs. Then we recover the original state. So we have this situation, right? So in general, we can have more complicated structure. It doesn't always have to be like that, but we can, then we say it's K extendable. And what we just saw here by this construction is that separable states are K extendable for every K. So you choose the K, and we can extend the correlation of A with this number of Bs. So what's interesting about this notion is that it completely characterizes entanglement. So if we have an entangled state rho AB, then it's entangled if and only if this rho AB is not K extendable for some K. So we have an entangled state that might be highly extendable, but they cannot be extendable for every K. So only classical correlations can be shared to as freely as you want. Quantum correlations, we always have a bound on how much they can be shared. So this comes actually from some old results in mathematical physics, that this quantum versions of the Definitive Theorem, and I won't get to that. So there is some easy examples here. For example, if we take any pure entangled state, then because it's pure, it cannot be correlated with anything else. So this cannot be too extendable, right? That's very simple. So a more interesting example, suppose we take again this d by d antisymmetric state that we considered before. Then it's entangled, and therefore it cannot be k extendable for every k. So you can find out that it's not d extendable, but it is d minus one extendable. So this shows that you might have to go to very high extensions to detect this, right? In this case, something proportional to the dimension of the state. So let me show you a picture. So here we have all quantum states, and suppose now we look at two extendable states. Then this is smaller, right? We have this constraint. Then three extendable states smaller. And then we continue, and what we just saw is that in this limit, this limiting set of infinitely extendable states, is exactly the set of separable states. So this idea gives a way of trying to come up with an algorithm to characterize entanglement. So the idea here is simple. So we want to answer two questions. First, how close to separable a state rho AB is if there is a K extension. So in a sense, we want to characterize the distance between the sets. So for the set of K extensions, how much bigger it can be than the separable state. And second, we'd like to know how computationally costly it is to check if a state has a K extension or not. So let's first address this question of how close a K extended state is from separable. And we already knew some results in this direction. So this follows from finite quantum definitive theorems. So a nice version is this one. Whenever we have a K extendable state, rho, then we can bound the distance to separable states, so this minimum distance to the separable state set, by something like constant times dimension b squared over k. So when k is very big, rho gets close to a separable state, as it should be. But here there is this, it depends on the square of the dimension of b, which might be something very costly. And unfortunately, this is close to optimal. So we have states for which we have this bound, like always bigger than constant times b over k. And probably by now you can guess which state this is, right? It's just you know, the unsymmetric state again, as always. So for the unsymmetric state, we have this this kind of bound, which is fairly big if you want to use this for an algorithm. So really, the key result behind this algorithm that I show you is an improved bound on this monogamy of entanglement. So what we show is that if we have a k-extendable state, suppose we look at this distance to separable state, but now using the LOCC norm. So you know this like more coarse-grained distance. Then we have a factor of square root, doesn't matter. We have this 1 over k dependence. But instead of having dimension of the local system, we have log of the dimension. So really, you have this huge difference between the LCC norm and the trace norm. The trace norm, the best you can have is something that depends on the dimension. The LCC norm, it might depend on the number of qubits, log of the dimension. So one thing that you get from that is that this highly extendable entangled state, for example, unsymmetric Fermat state, where the number of extensions increases with the dimension, they must be data hiding, in the sense that the LCC norm to separable state must be much smaller than the trace norm. So you know they must have this, they must look like a separable state with respect to any LCC protocol you implement. But nonetheless, if we apply a global measurement, they are very far away from separable. So it just come out of proof. So the best intuition that I can give is that the canonical example why we have that bound, which is the unsymmetric Fermat state, here we already knew that it was much better. And what we show here is actually that this is not a coincidence. It's actually always the case. But yeah, I don't have any deeper intuition. So now the algorithm, how to get it, I don't want to get into the details, but it's very simple. So it turns out that searching, suppose you have a state rho AB, and you want to see if there is an extension rho AB1 to BK. Then this is something called a semi-definite program. And so if you want to know if the state is separable, epsilon A to separable, it suffices by this result to look for an extension of this order, like order log A over epsilon squared. So if there is this extension, if there isn't this extension, we know this state is at least epsilon away from separable in LOCC norm. So we just have to search for this symmetric extension of this order using semi-definite programming. And then if we set up the SDP, the size of the SDP is just the size of this extension. And the dimension is like a squared times b to the power of 2k. K is of this order. And then we see that the size of the SDP is exactly this running time. It's like 2 to the log a log b over epsilon squared. And we can solve SDP polynomially, and then we get a runtime. So really, the new thing here is this kind of definite bound for LOCC norm. Really, we can improve a lot. We can go from something that depends on the dimension to something that depends on the number of qubits. And this is the main thing here. So I don't want to get into the proof, how we show this inequality. So it's actually, I just want to say what the kind of things that we use. Yes?
The trace norm, you had this factor 1 over k, it was optimal, okay?
Yeah.
Do you have any this bound type?
Yeah. So yeah, we can show that we need this log dimension over k is tight. We have an example. Okay. I can tell you later. It's not complicated, but it's more complicated than this unsymmetric state. But yeah, you cannot improve this. This is tight. I mean, maybe the square root factor is not tight, but really, this ratio is tight. OK, so we proved this by combining three results, like recent results. One is that you know you can understand this strong subjectivity of Fanoima entropy and how it deviates from zero, or in other words, the conditional mute information, as a problem in Shannon theory that we call state redistribution problem. The other one is some kind of large deviation theory theorem for entangled states. So we want to tell if you have entangled state or any separable state. We can find the optimal rate of this problem. And last, we use some properties of entangled measure called Cauchy entanglement. So like putting together these three results in the right way is the key to prove this inequality. But I don't want to say more than that. OK, so this is what I want to say about the connection of data hiding with the separability testing. So the lesson here is that you know this these data hiding correlations, they are, in a sense, the most nasty one, at least if you want to characterize entanglement. So now I want to talk about something slightly different, and I want to talk about a different type of data hiding, which is the one where instead of having this locality constraint on the measurements, we have some computational constraint on the measurements. So let me present first this result, which I think is nice. So suppose it says that most quantum states on n qubits for n sufficiently large, they will look like the maximum mixed state if we can only implement measurements, if we can only implement efficient measurements, meaning measurements that we can create by a circuit of size polynomial in n. So it's so what we mean by most, we mean with respect to the Haar measure. So suppose we have a fixed, this all zero state, we apply a Haar unitary U to this state, and then we have a pure state. And then if we take this U distributed according to the Haar measure on the unitary group, then we have a distribution on states. Then if you look at distributions on these states with probability exponentially close to 1 in n, every state will have the same statistics as the maximum entangled state if we can only use efficient measurements. So it means, like, you know, you have this huge Hilbert space. For most part of this huge Hilbert space, we don't care about it, because it's just maximum mixed from what concerns us.
Sorry, yeah. Just a clarification. So you create the state
yeah.
with the unitary, which is not restricted.
Yeah, this, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And you only impose restrictions on how you evaluate the state afterwards.
Yeah, yeah. So then for most of these states, which might be very hard to prepare, we are going to get to that, they will look just like maximum mixed state.
So you're not putting constraints on how you prepare them?
That's where we're going. We're heading. But at the moment, no.
You are not.
Yeah. So just to remind, you know, this Haar measure is just a rotational invariant measure on the unitary group. So a particular example of this result, which maybe is more well known, is this result from 2008 by Gross and collaborators and Bremen and collaborators, which they show that most quantum states, in the same sense, using this Haar measure, they are useless for measurement-based quantum computation. So if you make these local measurements, they look like maximum mix. Actually, it's more general. If you do anything efficient that you can implement efficient, they will look like maximum mix. So this is the precise statement. Suppose you have a, let's call QCK, quantum computation K, the set of two outcome P of M's, identity and identity minus A, sorry, A and identity minus A, that can be implemented by a circuit with K gates. Then what we can prove, and this is kind of folklore, but it's very easy to prove. So it's that the probability of a Haar measure, so we look at states drawn from the Haar measure, and we look at the optimal bias of distinguishing this state psi when we measure A, and when we measure A on a maximum mixed state, under any P of M A, which belongs to this class. So any P of M which is efficient. Then the probability that it is bigger than epsilon is something doubly exponentially small in n. And it will be, there will be an epsilon square here that I forgot. So, you know, even for epsilon, which is like 1 over poly, this is doubly exponentially small. So it means that almost every state will look like this maximum big state. And we can use Levy's lemma and epsilon net on this right set to prove this. So, right. So this is nice, but there is a problem here. And it is that to sample from the Haar measure, even with error epsilon, we need exponential resources. So if we want to create this state, this will require exponential resources as well. So it will require exponential amount of bits and quantum gates. So for example, most quantum states, consequence of this, most quantum states require this exponential number of 2-qubit gates, even to be approximately created. So the question that I want to address is, can we have this, you know, we can think of this result as data hiding against computationally bounded measurements. So we are hiding data whether we have a particular pure state or the maximum mixed state. So you know, if we don't have any restriction, we can of course distinguish both of them very well. But with this restriction, we cannot simply. So what I want to address is, this is the interesting kind of data hiding, but it's, you know, there is this problem that to create this kind of states, we need exponential resources as well. So perhaps it's not fair to ask for polynomial measurements. So the question is really, can we have these data hiding states against computationally bounded measurements, but now states that we can prepare efficiently? So this is what I want to address. And to talk about this, turns out that the right tool is to consider some notions of quantum pseudo-randomness. And what it says is that sometimes, you know, whenever we use a hard random unitary, we can just replace it by some pseudo-random unitaries, which are more efficient to implement and still have the same properties as the hard measure in what concerns for particular problems. So I want to consider these quantum unitary tree designs. So their definition is the following. Suppose we have an ensemble of unitaries. So this is a measure on the unitary group. And we say it's an epsilon approximate unitary tree design. If for every monomial, so this U P1 Q1 is the entry of this unitary in positions P1 Q1, etc. So we have a monomial which has T entries of the unitary and T entries of the complex conjugates of the unitary. And then we look at the expectation value with respect to this measure mu of any monomial, of this monomial, with respect to the measure mu and with respect to the hard measure. And we want they are close to each other. So the error is like, you know, some explanation is more in T and epsilon. And then we call this a T design. So why we're interested in these T designs? Because we believe we can implement them efficiently. So, you know, conjecture you can have is that there are efficient epsilon approximate unitary T designs. Efficient means that the unitaries can be created by polynomial resources in the number of qubits, the order of the design, and log 1 over epsilon. And the measure should be able, we should be able to sample from the measure in polynomial time as well. So we had many results in this direction. I just want to show one of them, which is this result from 2008. And it says that we indeed have these efficient constructions, but only when T is up to n log n. So higher than this, we don't know. So one way to consider unitary designs is by considering a very simple kind of structure, which is just a random quantum circuit. So suppose, let's define this local random circuit, which is the following. In each step, we choose an index. So the lines here are qubits. And in each step, we choose an index from 1 to n uniformly at random. Then chosen this position, we are going to apply a 2-qubit gate to the position I and to position I plus 1. And this 2-qubit gate is drawn from the Ha measure, but only in U form, you know, on this 2-qubit space. And we concatenate this many times. So this induces a distribution on the unitaries. And we would like to understand this distribution. So this is a random walk on the unitary group. You know, there is this more famous random walk on the orthogonal group, this Kax random walk that maybe some of you know. And this model was first introduced in this paper by Hayden and Prescu. And they tried to use this model to, you know, have a toy model for dynamics, local dynamics in a black hole. But, you know, this is like this is a reasonable model of local random dynamics, for example. Right, so there have been a lot of work. I will skip this. So people studied this before, and the best result was that these random circuits, they have three designs. But the conjecture is that we can actually go all the way up to polynomial design. And this is what we analyzed with Aram Haro and Michal Horodesky. And what we have now is that the conjecture is true. So we can, if we have a local random circuit of size n squared, t to the 5, then this is an epsilon approximate unitary t design. So, you know, like maybe t to the 5 is, polynomial in n and t. Probably this t to the 5 we could improve it, but we don't know. Right, so why this is interesting? This is interesting because now we can improve a little bit on this result, this form of data Heising that I showed you before. So what we can prove using this result is that most quantum states that can be created now by circuits of size n to the k. So you know, you consider the set of states which can be created by circuits of a given size. Then this guy will look like maximal mixed states for every circuit of size n to the k over 6. So you know, it's clear that if the way you prepare this state is just by a circuit of a given size, you cannot allow measurements of circuit of size bigger than this. Otherwise, you could just undo the circuit and distinguish all zero states from maximal mix. So we really need a separation here. But even to get this separation was, we didn't know how to do before. So with this T-design result, we can get this kind of separation. And most is defined in terms of this measure on quantum circuits given by this local random circuit model. So it means that if you have a generic state that you can create efficiently, this will have very good data Heising properties, at least with respect to this smaller measurements, smaller complexity measurements. So the proof, don't worry about it. I just want to say that it's the same idea from this original result. We use some small probability result plus some epsilon net. The only difference is that this measure concentration result, Levy's lemma, that was used in the HAR random case, we replaced by a T-design bound from this paper. And now, because we have this polynomial design, we get something that is good enough for what we want. So this is what this equation says. It's not very important. Right, so how we prove this? Here too, I don't want to get into the details, but it was also putting together three results again. So one, we want to understand how fast this random walk converges to the unitary group. And the way we do it, we lower bound the convergence gap of this random walk. So what we could do is we can relate this convergence gap to the spectral gap of a particular many-body Hamiltonian, local Hamiltonian. And once we do this, we can employ a technique proved by Nartegale that allows us to lower bound spectral gap of a particular kind of Hamiltonians, which is the kind that we have. Then once we do this, to apply this theorem, we need to understand the structure of the ground space of this Hamiltonian. And then, lucky for us, because of the structure of our problem, the ground state is very simple. It's like product states. And we need to know how they overlap. And then this comes this, you know, this fact that permutation matrices, they are approximately orthogonal to each other. Then using this, we can get a really good bound from this result by Nartegale. And then the final thing that we need is just, we need a very, because of this result, we need to show convergence really to the HAR measure, but just at exponentially small rate. And this we can do using techniques from Markov chain. We use this path coupling in particular. But so this is roughly how it goes. Right. So this is what I had to present. Now I just want to, you know, a couple of slides, give some speculations about a problem that I find very nice, but unfortunately I have no idea how to solve, which is concerned with area loss. So here the idea is the following. Suppose we have a H is a local Hamiltonian on a lattice. It can be in one dimension, two dimensions, etc. So we have like spins, for example, here in this rectangle. And suppose we have interactions which are just nearest neighbor between these qubits, or short range interactions in general. Then suppose we have this Hamiltonian, and we can consider the ground state of the Hamiltonian, so the lowest energy eigenstate of the Hamiltonian. And then, you know, there is some intuition that this psi zero, it should not be very complex. It should not be at least as complex as a generic state. And there is several ways you can try to formalize this intuition. One way is related to this area loss. So we have this conjecture that says that whenever H is gapped, so there is, you have the ground state, the ground energy, and you have the first excited energy, and there is a gap which doesn't scale with the system size when you increase the system. Then rho r is the reduced state of the ground state in this region r. Then the entropy of this should scale only as the boundary of the region. So, you know, just as the perimeter of this region here, and not as the volume. So if you have a general quantum state, the entropy will scale as the volume, the number of particles here. So this conjecture says that ground states of gapped Hamiltonians are simple enough that it only scales with the boundary, which is something much smaller. So in a sense, the entanglement in this ground state is limited. So this is what we would like to see if it's true or not. We have several results in this direction. So first, for particular models, XY model or quasi-free bosonic models, we can prove that this is true. Second, there is a general proof by Hastings for any gapped model that in the ground states, we might not have area law, but we have something called exponential decay of correlation. So if we measure two observables which are far away, the correlations will look as if we had just product states between these regions. On the other hand, we also have some results which tell that if you don't have a gap, even in 1D, you should not expect that you have this area law. So even in 1D, we can have systems with volume law. So really has to be something about the gap that makes this area law true. Finally, the most important result so far here is that for one-dimensional systems, every gapped Hamiltonian satisfies area law. And this was proved by Hastings, 2007. So it's a really nice result. And recently, by Arad and collaborators, they could improve this for frustration-free models in the sense that the bound here on the spectral gap is exponential in the spectral gap. Now they get something polynomial in the spectral gap. Right, so why I'm talking about this problem here? So because it's connected to data hiding, in a sense. So what we know is true by this result of Hastings is that the systems, they have this decay of correlations. So meaning that suppose we break our lattice in three regions, A, B, and C. B is a small region of depth L that separates A and C. Then what these results say, what exponential decay of correlations say, is that if we measure observable on A X and on C Y, then the probability, this acceptance probability trace rho AC X tensor Y, is very close to the situation where instead of having rho AC, we have rho A tensor rho C. And how close depends on the separation between them. It's exponentially small in the separation. So this is true for any X and Y with like operator norm smaller than one. So intuitively, we could think that this implies that rho AC is just a product state, right? Because if we measure anything on A and C, we have no correlation. So maybe the state is close to product state. And if this were true, it would be really nice because it would imply area law. And it would imply because the rank of this guy, rho AC, is just the rank, is at most the size of this region B. And this L is like something's fixed. And this is the area of A exactly. So it would mean that the rank of rho A has to be proportional to the size of B, area law. So this is very intriguing. Unfortunately, this intuition doesn't work. And it doesn't work exactly because we have these data hiding states. So this was around before, but in this paper by Hastings, really he makes this clear. So the idea is that we have states where we have exponential decay of correlations, but they are very far away from product. They have a lot of correlations, even though we cannot see them locally. So that's too bad. One question is if this kind of argument can still work if only we use the right form of decay of correlations. Maybe we can come up with a stronger form of decay of correlations that implies area law. And this is what I have been thinking about. So we have two possibilities to go here. So let's generalize this exponential decay of correlations in two ways. One is that we can call some one-way LOCC decay of correlations. Suppose we have the following setting. Alice and Bob, they want to measure observable in the system, where Alice makes a measurement. Then conditional on the outcome she got, she communicates to Bob, and Bob makes another measurement. Then the kind of observed that they can measure is exactly of this form. It's like sum over k, xk, yk, where xk is just a POVM element. And for each k, Bob measures a different POVM. So yk is just a POVM element by itself for each k. Then instead of just using this product measurements, we can try to use this kind of measurement and define a notion of decay of correlations for this kind of measurement. So what is fairly easy to prove is that this form of decay of correlations, we can call this one-way LCC decay of correlations, it actually implies area law. So this is strong enough. The trouble here is that we don't know if this is satisfied for gap systems. So we know Hastings proved that this kind of exponential decay of correlations is true for gap systems. This stronger form, we don't know if it's true. So we don't know if, yes. Because this x, they are all positive semi-definite, these operators. So the sum over k of xk is smaller than identity. So this defines a POVM. So it means that Alice can measure this POVM, and then condition on getting the outcome k, she communicates it to Bob, and Bob measures a POVM given by a yk and identity minus yk. And then post-electron patient yk. So this sum, sum over k, xk, yk comes from one-way LCC protocol. So this is enough for area law, which is, give some indication that maybe some form of the right form of decay of correlations is enough. But this, we don't know if it's satisfied by gap systems. So that's a problem. Then we also have some opposite results. So let's consider something weaker than this, but still stronger than that this standard decay of correlations that we can call guessing probabilities. So here the kind of measurement you can do is very similar. So it's like a sum over k, xk, yk. But now xk, they define a POVM, and the yks define a POVM together as well. So before each yk define its own POVM, Now the sum over y case has to be smaller than identity. So the situation we are interested in here is like Alice measures a pure a measurement given by xk. This induces an ensemble on Bob, and then we are interested in the guessing probabilities of Bob. So Bob wanna guess which state Alice prepared there by measuring a pure VM. And then we can say, okay, so now let's call this guessing probability exponential decay of correlations the same thing, the same sort of thing that we had before. So the good thing about this, so you know, it's weaker than this because instead of each one being smaller than identity, the sum of them have to be smaller than identity. So now we reverse the order. So now we can prove that this is satisfied by gap systems. So you know, these gap systems, they satisfy even this stronger form of decay of correlations. The trouble is that we don't know if this implies error or not. The good thing is that we don't have a counterexample here as well. So this Hastings argument doesn't actually work here. So you know, I think maybe one of them or somewhere in between them might be the right way to try to address this question. So that's it. Let me just summarize. You know, we saw that these quantum correlations can be hidden in some interesting ways. Concerning LOCC data hiding entangled states, we saw that in a sense they are the hardest one to characterize to decide if they're entangled or not. And this is because the correlations in these kind of states can be much more shareable than correlations in non-data hiding states. Then we saw how we can hide data against efficient measurements, even when the preparation of the state is efficient. And the result behind this was, you know, to give these efficient constructions of epsilon approximate unitary designs and show that random circuits do the job. And then we saw this fact that data hiding is an obstruction to area law that we know. And I hint to two possible ways to try to overcome it that I have no idea if they will work, but I find something fun to think about. And maybe this guessing probability is enough, but I don't know. So that's it. Thanks.
Hey, do we have any more questions for Fernando?
Yes.
Okay, my question is, what's your personal opinion? Can one hope for any kind of very explicit trade-off between computational complexity of preparing a state and the complexity of distinguishing it from?
Yeah.
It's because here all the statements are probabilistic, and one would like a statement of the kind that, for example, the complexity of preparing a state measured in some way, and the complexity of distinguishing the state from the maximum state are proportional or related in some way, but in a very explicit deterministic manner. Do you think it's
So you want to, because we showed that usually if you have a random circuit, most states will have its properties, but you don't want this probabilistic state.
Well,
you want the deterministic construction?
What I would like to have is a statement of the form that say compute the complexity of preparing a state divided by the complexity of distinguishing a state from something maximum mix is greater than some constant. For example, a state
in general, it's not true, right? Because there are examples where you need like for example n square gates to create a state, but you can still distinguish it from maximum mix very efficiently. But maybe if you want just explicit examples, then I think it's a good question, but we don't have. So probably what is true is that we have the separation, n to the k versus n to the k over 6. I'm sure this can be improved a lot, but we don't know how to do it.
So this hardness of distinguishing, telling whether the state is separable when one measures performance with the base norm or LOCC norm, seems to me similar to what happens in tomography when one asks for the convergence in the base norm. And in that case, in the case of tomography, it is known that if you select instead of finite percent of quantities, that's for the convergence only of the expectation values of this quantity.
I see.
One has a much better convergence.
I see.
Could it be possible that something like this happens here?
So you say instead of using LOCC, we fix a set of measurements we want to
finite set.
Yeah, and then but then we need like for most states, then this defines a norm. Well, let me see. The thing is that these measurements that you chose, they might be exactly the ones that achieve the trace norm from one of these states, right? And then for this state, clearly you cannot compare it in trace norm. So maybe it might be true, but you have to put some probabilistic, you know, you have to say, fix the measurements, the POVM elements you care about. Then for both states, you can decide much more efficient. It's easy. Maybe it's true. Yeah. I don't know if what we did can be applied. Actually, probably not. But Although the only thing that LCC is actually a very large set, right? So yeah. So this discretization, I'm not sure if it would work for LCC, but it's in the same. Yeah, I agree. It's similar. Yeah. It's a good point.
Yeah.